Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Reveille, reveille, reveille!
Welcome back to another edition of Zero Block 30. Chaps, we got Cons and Kate here too. We're getting ready to do another wrap-up. Obviously, there's been a lot of information that's taken place just in four short days, and I think that sometimes when there's huge events going down in the world, 4 days between episodes can seem like a lifetime. It could seem like a whole cycle. It can seem like everything's changed. There's been so many developments in the last 96 hours essentially, where one, we thought that we saw maybe the greatest single story in Ukrainian or like in wartime that we've seen in a long time, as far as group valor with the Snake Island situation where they said Russian warship, go fuck yourself. The initial reports there from across the globe, multiple media outlets, was all 13 died. Now this morning, it comes out that they are not dead, but they are POWs. And it was almost like this feeling on the internet where it was like, oh, well, that's a bad thing. Like, no, dude, they're good. Like, they're alive.
That's
they're
a great thing.
They're prisoners of war, which obviously sucks. Nobody wants to be a prisoner of war. That would be awful, but they're not dead. So there's hope that they're going to be able to rejoin their families one day. And that's what you should choose to think about rather than them being dead. And it ruins some internet folklore thing that nobody should give a fuck about since the people are alive. Like, they're alive. Yeah. That's great. Like,
that's what matters.
We want people to live. Like, that's a... I think that's maybe a ZBT only thing, like as far as military bases.
Yeah.
We want people to live. Like, we're not down for everybody dying. Putin, however, he can feel free to die anytime he wants to. That's his prerogative. And I hope Ukrainians help him out with that at some point. That would be fantastic. But we are going to cover some other things today as well, because we have three rounds in the magazine. Round number one. Although the war is going to be the focus of most of the show and of the entire world's attention, we're going to talk about some other stuff too, because our brains need a break. And we're going to start with the simple question of, should we kill every single mosquito on the face of the earth? Kate, the fucking horse story that you had. Remember?
The horse story? Oh,
horse.
Assateague Island. Mm-hmm. Yes. Quick refresher for those who don't know, when I was underage and couldn't go
to the
bars.
We'll get into that in the actual round, kit.
I was naked. There was mosquitoes.
Every time I hear a story and about horses. Vicious mosquitoes, it's the first story that pops into my brain now. First,
unless you tell me there's some huge benefit of mosquitoes, I'm just flat out saying, no, we don't need them. So we'll find out,
Cons, because we're going to get into that in round number one. Round number two, heat waves have caused our beloved honeybees to ejaculate themselves to death, which brought up some memories of a ZBT group chat and with our old guy, Kyle, who's still in on it as well. And then finally, round number three, we're going to get into all the updates from Ukraine. We have an awesome interview with Nola Haynes, who is a professor at Pepperdine. She is a graduate of Harvard Divinity School and has been working in national security for a while. She's been doing all kinds of things and briefing and works with some nonprofits. She's a very impressive person. I learned a lot sitting down and talk with her. You will too. There are some points that need to be made that she makes that I had never thought about and probably wouldn't have ever thought about if I'd have lived 50 lifetimes. And I always find those are the conversations, like when I leave them, and where it is really remarkable what some people put together that I never would, because our perspectives in life from the way that we approach things, the way that we were raised, the way that we were educated, the way that we were brought up, all those things come together at a culmination. And you could end up with groupthink in a lot of ways, with military backgrounds and military veterans and the way that we approach the war. You can almost have groupthink. So it's nice to have somebody come in, not that doesn't have uniform experience, but has a lot of insight and intellect to go along with it. You're going to enjoy that interview. And it's all going to be brought to you by our good friends at Whistlepig. If you haven't tried Whistlepig yet, I'm not sure what you were waiting for. It's fantastic. It's delicious. It's light. It's refreshing. It's a piggyback barrel aged craft cocktail that comes in a can. It's so much better than seltzer. It's crisp, refreshing, and super bold. People are going bananas. I put up a poll. Or no, maybe John did. Somebody did. Blackberry is the overwhelming favorite. Did you guys? I would have thought it was citrus mint.
Oh, blackberry makes sense. So yeah, the other day too. I needed like a refreshing, but they're all refreshing, but I went with the citrus mint, and then the ginger too is delicious. But I don't know. There's something about the color of the blackberry one that's just, it's just, yeah, a treat.
I love purple. I mean, if a good purple or lavender,
but it's
shows
not
up,
purple, but it's like this beautiful, you're right. It's like this, like fuchsia? It's a fancy drink. It's a fancy drink color. I don't know. I love it.
It is. Mm. And it's great in a can, or it's, I think it's even more delightful when you pour it out over ice and you're in like a pint glass. You just feel like you're just having the time of your life. It's great. Make sure you go check some out at piggybackcraftcocktail.com for more, or you could just grab them in your local stores. They're showing it up. And it's so cool to see like the social media whenever people are posting that they got it. They're like, hell yeah, it's in my local store. I don't have to pay for shipping anymore. Good. Just go get it. That's all that we care about, is that you're buying some Whistlepig, helping us out and helping them out. All right, let's get going with the show today. Lots of stuff going on in the world. We're not starting with Ukraine stuff. We're moving on.
No.
We're going to do that last. That makes sense because that's what we want to talk about a lot. Kate, let's get going with round number one. Let's talk about what we have here with some mosquitoes to see if Cons can get rid of all of them or not.
Round number one. Yes. As you know, I have extensive experience of mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. One, when I think I was 19, 20, long story short, me and my buddies went down to Ocean City, Maryland on a whim on a Friday night in the summer, thinking we could find a hotel room and find some adult to buy us booze and whatever. We found the adult to buy us booze. We could not get ourselves a hotel room. We went down to Assateague Island, like 30 minutes south, to we'll just camp out, whatever. I got very drunk, went skinny dipping in the middle of the night. You could hear horse hooves clopping around
in the ocean. I think skinny dipping in the ocean is a dangerous move, Kate.
Yeah, well, if you have a penis, maybe. I don't have anything dangling that a fish would be.
Well, what about people that have, that are subscribed and post consistently on our long boobs?
Now I would have an issue, but back then I was okay.
Okay.
Long story short, I woke up in the morning. I just slept out under the stars with no bug spray, and they do not spray that island for mosquitoes, like whatever. And I looked like I had leprosy, pretty much. Ugh. What happened there. It was one of the worst. When I tell you, they got in every crevice of my body. Like, I was so passed out, I didn't feel them crawling into my britches. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So that was rough.
Mm. Anyway, I always think it's whenever you have those moments and somebody is covered in mosquito bites. Ant bites is terrible too. When I was little, my grandfather, we would go outside and we were constantly barefoot. I mean, it's just like a Northern Florida thing, just never wear shoes in the summer. And so I was outside standing in a fire ant pile, and I didn't know it until they started biting, and both of my feet were just completely ate up, where it has like the white pimples all over, almost covered my entire feet. And anytime somebody saw me for the next couple of days, whenever they could see the ant, they'd be like, they make that noise like that.
With those ant bites, can you like pop them?
Yeah, you can, but then it makes it even more itchy, and
makes
then you're prone to infection. So what my grandma did, I don't know if this is even effective or not, she would put in like the big pot that you would cook like spaghetti noodles in, and she would put apple cider vinegar and our homemade aloe plants. You would break a couple limbs off and put it in there. And she would just tell me to soak my feet. And honest to God, I don't know if it was a placebo effect, but it worked.
And then would just turn around and make spaghetti with that same mixture.
That's
right.
I have this memory from childhood, my cousin's stuff getting stung by bees, and my aunt, I swear, this would mix like mustard with mud and like vinegar and a couple other things and make like this little mud patch. I don't know if whatever.
Makes sense, because like even with, that's probably the same thing, because mustard is vinegar based. It's probably the vinegar and mustard that works.
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
And vinegar will clean your plates. All right, let's get on with the story.
The other thing too, Paris Island, sand fleas, mosquitoes, whatever. We would get done chow. We would all form up outside, and then they make us put our arm on the recruit next to us and look at it. And you would just have to watch. They'd say, time for the sand fleas to eat their dinner. Is what the drill instructors say. And you would just sit there and look at your arm as all the sand fleas landed on it and sucked you dry.
And the drill instructor's putting on like, what was that shit called? Like the
beet
skin so soft. No, like skin so soft, because it wouldn't smell like bug spray. And they would put it on like in front of you and then just stand outside whenever the sand fleas are like feasting and you can't move or like scratch or anything. And they'll be like, one day this might save your life, but right now it's just enjoyable for us.
We need blood, but the fleas keep sucking. You know what
exactly
I mean?
Exactly right.
Kate. Am I right, gang?
Exactly
anyway,
right.
This comes to us from Live Science. Mosquitoes, folks. Throughout human history, wars, battles, and conflicts are thought to have resulted in the deaths of around 1 billion with a B people. But that's nothing compared with the number of humans killed by mosquitoes. The journal Nature suggests that nearly half of all humans who have lived during the last 50,000 years owe their death to this deadly insect and its capacity to transmit one particular disease, malaria.
Isn't that insane? Half of the people who have ever lived on Earth died because of a mosquito bite.
Mosquito bite.
That's crazy when you put it in that context.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Black Plague was fleas, the bugs and all that shit's crazy. Mosquitoes are central to the spread of malaria, which is caused by a parasite that killed around 627,000 people in 2020 alone.
Well done on the number, Kate. You
as I was reading it, my brain was like, keep going, bitch, keep going, bitch, keep going. And I did
think Kate does really well when there's nothing after the comma. There's stuff after the comma, that's when she
forget
gets
it.
Tripped up.
And then you throw in a million in there. Oh, Lord.
Forget
of
it. No, yeah. Forget it.
Well, 627,000 people in 2020 alone, as well as viruses such as Zika, West Nile, and the dengue. The Anopheles gembe mosquito, which is common in rural parts of Africa, is often dubbed the most dangerous animal species on Earth, according to a 2020 study.
So, I would kill to have Zika back instead of coronavirus. Just give me Zika. Because we thought Zika was a big deal. Zika was here and gone in like half of a supper. Like I've had dinners longer than Zika was around.
Yeah, that was that people were a little afraid to go to Disney, but that was it. So given that mosquitoes are so deadly, should we just kill them all? And if we were to take such drastic measure, what would the consequences
be? Now, I know you guys haven't read the article. What do you think? Because there is this book. I picked it up at the airport. Airport's really the only place I ever buy books.
Yeah,
and it's like a weird thing. If I'm in there, I'm just naturally drawn to Hudson books. Like I have to go in there and buy something. I bought this book called What If, and it takes these questions that like second, third graders would ask their parents or their teachers, and it actually answer them. So like one of them be like, what would happen if God had huge hands and just stopped the Earth from rotating in the middle of the solar system? What would happen? And they go into a physics lesson about what would actually happen, how people's bodies would essentially just turn
to mush.
Kurt
Vonnegut book, by the way, Time Quake, great book.
Oh, shit. So yeah, like there's a lot. Yeah. What do you guys think would happen if we got rid of mosquitoes off the top of your head? Cons, we'll start with you.
We would have much more enjoyable summers and barbecues outside in the evening hours.
Mm-hmm.
Kate? Yes. But I think so many other animals like birds would be fucked because that's like their number one dinner probably. And then whoever eats birds would be fucked. And then whoever eats the birds would be fucked.
That's what it seems like, right? Like it seems like everything, just like economy. Whenever you talk about Ukraine and Russia, where you're like, well, they are the top two producers of wheat in the entire world. And so now wheat's going to be more expensive. They also have a lot of natural gas. You're going to pick that up. That's going to make 18-wheelers more expensive, which causes everything. And there's this chain of reaction. So you would assume everything together is connected under the sun. Like that's just the way it's always
circle
been.
Circle life. Yeah.
That's the way it's going to be. Let's see if that's actually true. Okay, here we go.
Oh, yes, that's me. That's for me to read. I thought you were about to tell me. I was so riveted. I said, oh, let's go. Well, before you grab the bug spray, know this. While some mosquitoes are dangerous to us, not all of them are. Even those that are sometimes harmful tend not to feed on humans, preferring honeydew, plant sap, and nectar, according to Mosquito Joe, Mosquito Control Company. There are around 3,500 mosquito species, but only around 100 will potentially bite and spread disease to humans. If humans decide to selectively eliminate disease-carrying mosquitoes, there are a few options.
One, so you got like 100 grunt mosquitoes, and then you have like 3,400 pogue mosquitoes.
Yeah, all the little pogue mosquitoes just hanging out. One such solution involves releasing mosquitoes carrying Wolbachia bacteria, so kind of diseasing them and wiping them out. Mm-hmm. However, given mosquitoes are a primary food source for numerous animals, including bats, birds, frogs, fish, and dragonflies, it's likely there would be at least some ecological impacts in the short term. Dragonflies, for example, are often known as mosquito hawks, owing to their ability to eat as many as 100 in a single day. It's likely
that being
they...
said, did you guys know that I'm going to have a dragonfly farm this year?
No.
Because I did a lot of research and reading about that last year because we have a pool and there's like oak trees and stuff here. So whenever the leaves come down, that's where mosquitoes will lay their larva, and they'll have like all the mosquitoes around. Mm. So we are going to have two separate pods of dragonflies that we're going to try to have to make them essentially military working dragonflies, taking out Smart. All the mosquitoes around my pool.
Smart. You know what else is a sign of a healthy yard?
What?
Ooh.
Like my friend bought a house and she was like, oh, I finally got one of these in my yard. I've seen one of these in my yard, which means the ecology of my yard's doing pretty good. Toads and frogs.
Oh.
They actually sell little toad and frog houses. These little things you could put a little water in, you keep them in the corners of your house. Yeah. So if you got toads and frogs in your yard, you're doing pretty well.
Damn.
Anyway, however, despite this lack of consequential clarity, people agree that it became possible to kill off every mosquito capable of transmitting malaria and other diseases, even if it also meant wiping out all mosquitoes that aren't dangerous and blah, blah, blah. Long story short, they're saying, I think we could kind of live without them.
We should do it. Saying, go ahead. All those other animals would find something else to eat.
You know they tried to do it?
No.
They did. And it happened at the University of Florida. And do you guys have love bugs up there?
We might call them something differently.
Like they're almost like little kind of flies, but not as strong wings. And they're often connected nut to butt, like, and they're flying in the sky like that. Did you know that's an invention from the University of Florida that they tried to genetically modify a certain bug and they were going to release it in the swamps of Okeechobee in Florida, Lake Okeechobee, and it was supposed to kill all the mosquitoes. Well, it did not work. And now there's just a thousand fucking ladybugs are love bugs everywhere.
Love bugs.
And those things are so acidic, they'll take the paint right off your bumper, Kate.
That's like the lantern flies. They leave this acidic like shit chart everywhere, all over like playgrounds and trees and whatever. That's
is that what you call either lightning bugs? Is
no. There's another
lantern flies. It's on the East Coast. They arrived a few years ago and they've just fucked shit up. They're fucking up beer. They're eating all the barley and hops and shit like that.
They're very detrimental to golf courses. So when you see them on the golf course, you're supposed to kill them because they like destroy trees and such on golf courses.
Can we take a pause real quick so I can make a show announcement?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I got corrected. All right. So there is cons. If there is a deficiency in the military, what do you need? If you can identify a deficiency, what do you need? To go along with a deficiency, a corrective action. That's exactly right. I got corrected on Twitter about my attitude towards cons. Whoa. I was told by a Twitter user that listened to the show. I can't remember her name off the top of my dome. She was like, listen, chaps, stop being so fucking mean to cons. His points are valuable. Stop interrupting him. So what we're going to do, interrupting jar. I am going to make a concerted effort to interrupt Cons and Kate way less.
Just interrupt us to tell us that?
I did, yes. That's how I drew it up.
In the jar.
So I am going to be interrupting way less and giving Cons the floor more because the people want to hear from Cons, whether it be about stuffed nachos, whether it be about whatever it is.
Charcuterie.
Cons has got it. Haircuts, anything that he wants to talk about. He's got the floor too. So I'm going to draw the line at West Point. Not going to do that. There's going to be some sort of decorum on the show.
Yes.
But that's how it's going to go. So there you go. That's my apology to Cons.
Yeah. Apology accepted. I appreciate that we are an organization, a squad, a show that looks to not stay stagnant and looks to improve as we continue on this journey. And we don't just accept mediocrity and we continue to look for ways to improve ourselves. So thank you very much. And thank you to that listener. And I saw Angie, you open your mouth just now. Yeah, Angie. Thank you, Angie.
So let's do anyway. Thumbs up, thumbs down on killing all mosquitoes. Up or down?
Oh, big time thumbs up. I'm big time
thumbs up. I'm thumbs up too. There's no consequence.
Did you know Hawaii didn't have any until 1826 when a foreign ship brought them there?
How pissed off would you be if you're Hawaiian?
I'd be so pissed. Oh my God. They live everywhere in the world except Antarctica and Iceland. And that it would fuck up the ecosystem basically though.
Kate, that we did talked about it on the Chaps and Kate show a while ago. And I think it was from Canada. Was it Canada that doesn't have mice?
Rats.
What was it that Canada doesn't have?
It was rats. Canada doesn't have rats. Or it's a certain area of Canada that doesn't
have rats. Wasn't it Alberta or British Columbia? Something like that.
I think it's Alberta that doesn't have rats. Yeah.
What yet. An accomplishment. Yeah. Imagine you could just hold them hostage. You'd be like, I got all these rats and I'm going to release them. And
this rat's about to pop 15 babies out and I'm going to squeeze her in a second and send them flying all over. Yeah. That was a weird thing to say.
Have you guys ever seen what a colostomy bag is tied to?
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Okay. Describe it the best you can.
Isn't it tied to you? Like it's a the poop.
Yeah, like
out,
I know what a colostomy bag you change is, it. But
yeah, but have you never seen the little thing that it attaches to? It looks like a bloody finger.
Yeah.
I didn't know, and it caught me off guard. I mean,
that come from?
Just thinking about things I don't know about, like rats and stuff. And recently, I saw this colostomy bag on TikTok.
I'm not making the connections here.
I'm not either, but I needed to tell you guys. And somebody took it off. They took off the colostomy bag, and it's like a bloody finger that you got to attach it to.
I see what you're saying now because I Google imaged it, and I understand that. And I never gave thought to that because I don't really want to think too highly or in depth about colostomy bags.
I've known a couple people who deal with that, and that's a tough go.
Yeah, it is a tough go. And I mean, honestly, if I could go back and somebody said, hey, dude, you could get a colostomy bag and just never have to deal with diarrhea ever again. You could eat whatever you want. It doesn't seem that bad.
But you got to wear that thing. No. You got to wear that thing.
Yeah, but Chaps would revel in that.
Yeah, I would. I would talk about it all the time.
Yes.
There's this other dude on TikTok. Kate, you might know him because, Cons, you don't do a whole lot of TikTok goofing. Mm-mm. Are you familiar with the diaper dynamo?
No.
Oh, it's a guy who's probably 30 and he's incontinent. He wears a diaper all the time, talks about it. It's fascinating, like his life and what he does. TikTok has taught me so much about folks that have different things going on medically that I would have never known about. It's fascinating.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Not to circle it back to what's going on with Ukraine and Russia. I feel like this round going off the rails is a symptom of, because like I couldn't, again, we said this last episode, constantly, all night long, I wake up, I'm sitting there holding the baby at 3 a.m. I'm typing in Russia, Ukraine, update. I'm feeling this sense of doom on my, and like, we are fortunate that we can step away from it. And I do feel like I am hitting the points where I'm like, hold on, let me shut off my brain for a second because there's nothing I can do right now. And I go to TikTok and I'm like, oh, cool.
And I do understand that. I know on a military show, it can feel like a little insensitive that we're talking about other things or even like posting on ZBT, like on the Instagram, Twitter. Like if it's not Ukraine related, you almost feel guilty for it. But in reality, there has not been a spot on the world that has not been going through armed conflict in the last like 3,000 years. It's constant and going on all the time. I think this one is obviously it's very different because it's two huge countries that have social media and they're all on TikTok. They're all dancing. They're all doing whatever. And then you just see it and it is difficult to move on to the next thing in your life. And I'm not sure what's right or wrong about that. It's just a statement of fact of how life is. But you can't constantly just be in other people's world and not worry about the one that is surrounding you too. Like it's a balance and it's a tough one to follow.
Yeah. I set my phone down a few times over the weekend. I'm like, I just need, cause I feel the sense of like, oh my God, I have to do so. Like you're seeing these things. You're like, oh my God, what do I do? And it's like, there's right now just waiting and keeping up with the, so anyway, it's kind of nice to, that sounds shitty, I guess. You feel bad for, talking about anything else, but you
still have a life. If you were back in Afghanistan and you were conducting operations in Afghanistan, would you want everyone in America just to constantly be thinking about what you're doing and if you're safe? My answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Of course. This is all about me. But there's
we had that for a good 3 years in the beginning. You know, we had that for a good. But.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have CNN, little con news network, and just talk about what he's doing in the Baghdad area. That'd be fantastic.
It was a crazy thought. I was looking at my son this week and we're playing in his room and I'm like, oh my God, like the war in Afghanistan went on for 20 years. And some of those kids at the end who were babies when it started, I was like, this would be like my son looking at him now and knowing that say we were in Ukraine 20 years from now, he would be in the army finishing up that war. Like, isn't that a crazy thought?
It's
like
nuts. Yeah,
it's hard to put it in perspective.
It's impossible. I don't think that there is any, like we say that all the time, and I think it's true. There is no perspective when you're talking about large-scale conflict and how long it lasted and how long it's going to last and all the different things. It's insanity that sometimes you need to sit back, relax with a little 3chi. 3chi is the industry leader in delta 8 THC products. that's a federally legal version of THC and is a much more functional alternative to marijuana. It gives you an amazing buzz and a great feel with clear head and less anxiety. Our guy Large was talking about it on Podfathers this morning, that he went to Disney World with his family, spent two full days at the park at Magic Kingdom and the other parks that are around, and he only got to ride four rides because the lines were so long at Disney. He was like, if I didn't have the 3-Chi drink additives that I could put in that have 20 milligrams of THC in it, I'd have lost my mind. So if you're going to go to one of those places, because mask mandates are essentially gone across the country now and everything's open back up, people have been waiting on going vacation. If you go like Large did to Disney World or someplace like that, right after the entire world opens up, buddy, you better bring some 3-Chi because you're going to be standing in line for a while. Go to 3chi.com. That's the number 3chi.com. Use the promo code blog to take 5% off your purchase. Must be 21 to purchase. Use responsibly. All right, let's move on to round number two. This one a little bit different. And I just put a couple more fun things in here because I didn't want the whole show to be sad and frustrating and anger inducing. So we're going to talk about bees coming. Kate, what do we got?
We got bees. Yeah, yes. We got bees. Bees cannot sweat. I don't think any insect can. So when a record-breaking heat wave hit back in June 2021, drones fled their colonies in search of water, some descending on the burlap sack covered kiddie pools dotting Emily Huxter's Armstrong British Columbia farm. At over 200 beats per second, bees' wings would have helped cool their tiny bodies as they desperately lugged water back to their colonies. Somewhere along the way, a lot of them didn't make it. That next morning, Huxter went out to her yard to check on her petite livestock. Dead drones everywhere, she remembers. In the grips of heat stress, their sex organs had exploded out of their bodies. The bees had ejaculated to death.
Ugh. If I had a nickel.
This is horrible.
You're a bee, honest to God, if you're a bee, that's a great way to go out. I mean, yes. What's your best case scenario? Dying as a bee, getting eaten by a dragonfly or something? Like, there's
no, I guess best case scenario is just flying and falling out of the sky of old age.
Yeah, but that ain't gonna happen. Like, we talk about that a couple weeks ago, that I don't think any animals really die of old age.
Do they?
Like, just humans die of old age.
Get out.
Yeah.
Whoa, like, when, hold on, time out. Honeybees lifespan 30 to 60 days. That's it.
When do they start coming, though? How do we know when they come?
Right.
Not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, keep going.
Yeah, they had incredible losses. Oh, so basically she said she found all these dead bees. They had their man parts out, she calls them. I'll be honest with you, I didn't know bees had genitals.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Me neither.
Like, I don't know comparatively to the rest of their bodies, just absolute units of genitalia.
I don't know how I thought they reproduced. Then she checked on roughly 300 starter hives where she rears her queens, each worth hundreds of dollars. About 70% were dead or missing. We had incredible losses. It was really scary, she said. Then we were like, oh my gosh, what's happening? So Huxter calls up the University of British Columbia. She calls up this researcher, Allison McAfee, who, postdoctoral student at the Beehive Research Center, had run experiments on how bees respond to heat. At 40 degrees Celsius, heat stress affects a bee's ability to mate. At 42 degrees Celsius, at least half of drones had been found to spontaneously ejaculate and die for some reason they haven't figured out. So that just goes to show people are like, oh, what difference does 1 degree make in the world scheme of things for a bee?
Yeah, bud. You're like sitting there one moment, you're just hovering around and doing all Colin Paul, and next thing you know, you comb yourself to death.
Right. Now, within weeks, thankfully, a lot of female bees survived because they're faking it still. Within weeks, climate scientists found the heat wave that scorched British Columbia and the U.S. Pacific Northwest was made 150 times more likely due to climate change. By 2040s, its record temperatures could return every 5 to 10 years. That's a lot of bee cum.
This next part is
turns
ridiculous.
Out it's not honey, as I had thought all these years.
Oh,
I thought that's what honey was. I've been feeling we had a hive back
kind of
home.
Pervert, if you look at it that always, way, just licking it up leaving. Like a big old honeybee cream pie.
Pineapples. I was leaving a lot of pineapples around for the bees.
You can make pineapple honey. Oh, actually, I have some. Let me show it
I'm
to
sure you.
You
do.
I do. Somebody sent it to me from Hawaii. Look at this.
Oh, wow.
Fancy.
Oh, man, that's a nice jar. That's a heck of a jar, too.
So this one is actually, it's honey that was pollinated from a pineapple grove, and then the honey was placed inside a rum barrel for a year.
Wow, interesting.
Wow, fancy.
That probably tastes delicious. But read this last part, Kate, because this is a number that really knocked my socks off.
Yeah, such extreme heat threatens more than bees or the honey they produce. The Armstrong Bee Farm is part of a network of beekeepers that provide pollination services for crops worth an estimated $5 billion a year in Canada.
I didn't realize there
were
$5
billion. Bees pollinate everything. Our whole world depends on bees, and we're fucking them up.
I was going to say, I respect these people for knowing this much about bees, but really, what does it matter if we know this or not? But then when you consider how much of the farming industry relies on bees, now I understand why it's important to know what's going on with them.
Yeah, it's wild that in 2022, you're like, oh shit, we can't do anything without bees.
Right? There's no other way. That's crazy. There's no other way to pollinate, but I guess not.
All right, so that was a weird round, and we did two weird rounds because we wanted to have some levity in the show before we get into the meat and potatoes of what we're actually here to talk about and what I imagine that you're here to listen about, given the events of the world. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off in what's going on in Ukraine. And before we really do that, I want to mention a couple things. One, man, this shit with propaganda is out of control. I'm getting to the point now where I told Coley, the editor-in-chief of the blog on Barstool, I told him, I was like, I'm not sure if other people should be blogging, or even Kate and I, about specific events of what's happening. Because even if it's confirmed by Ukrainian sources, or if it's confirmed by the EU, it might not be true. Because
I posted a blog that was confirmed by the Associated Press, had actual quotes attributed to the president of Ukraine, and then it turns out, you know... So
even the story we got about the soldiers on the island originally reported as dead, and then now we find out they're just POWs.
Yeah, so the president of Ukraine confirmed that and was using it and was talking about it to get the fighting spirit. First, let me ask you, I guess, like a philosophical question of how do you feel about different governments using propaganda to their benefit or to the enemy's detriment? Tons, we'll start with you.
I think it's, you know, the expression all's fair in love and war. I think it is a necessary thing that has to be addressed. And it's something that's been used for many, many decades in the course of war. And we've seen the memes and things of that nature floating around the internet. There was paper propaganda that was used during other conflicts back in exactly.
Chaps has a whole wallpaper, but yeah.
Propaganda is not new. So to say that now all of a sudden, because the internet is much more powerful than dropping leaflets, that we should all of a sudden stop doing it, I just think it is something that's necessary. Because I think we've seen now with Ukraine standing up to Russia, how important the mental state of your fighting force is. And propaganda is one way to influence that mental state.
Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, when I read that initial story of Russian warship, go fuck yourself, I wanted to run through a brick wall. So I could only imagine how it made Ukrainians feel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's important. Like, that's a part of war. It's an important part of war. And I feel like this is a very clear case of good versus a very specifically bad man and making really evil choices, causing a lot of death and destruction to both sides needlessly. And so this little voice in my head's like, is it really that bad then? If there's some stories coming out from the Ukraine that fucking pump people up, I'm like, fuck it. I don't know. So
Major General Mark Hertling had a thread on Twitter where he was talking about this type of thing. And I thought he made some fantastic points, especially when you're the smaller force. You need propaganda on your side because you will not survive without the will to fight. And having those personal stories is what gives you that will to fight. Like, it having that, if you're like, well, he could do it, she could do it, then I could do it, and it gives you that sense of confidence where you can go out. I mean, that's why it was when Jason Dunham first got the Medal of Honor, the first Marine during OAF and OEF that received the Medal of Honor for what he did in combat actions. When that happened, you looked across the Marine Corps at the time and people were like, oh shit, here we go. And not saying what happened to Jason Dunham is propaganda by any means, but I am saying that story, and whenever you see somebody that gets something what you would consider good, like a Medal of Honor. It's a morale booster, and you have that. And people talked about that World War II with John Bassalone. That was the reason why they took Bassalone off the War Bonds tour and put him back into a front yard unit, because everybody knew who he was. He was this badass. He had the Guadalcanal story already.
Yeah,
and
it can be true too. There's a lot of true propaganda. Like, you know, this town sees these Ukrainians going arm in arm and standing against a tank. Well, that fucking pumps you up. So share it. Like,
I mean, there's a shit ton of stories, and we're going to get into what's going on here as we sit. Go ahead. Yes, Kate.
Wait a minute. Is this thing on?
Oh, lotion.
Is this thing on?
Okay.
I have a bit of a roast.
Oh, because President Putin has been such a piece of shit, Kate is going to do her own propaganda for, I guess, Ukrainians, so they can see this on the front lines. Kate's going to roast President Putin. Here it is.
They'll all see it. Hello, Putin. Pretend everyone that I'm speaking to, Putin's right here.
Right.
Okay. He's in the room. He's at the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah. He's sitting next to Bieber and Ludacris.
Right. Classic. One thing's for sure, Mr. Putin. I'm going to take time. My sweet time during this roast, because I most certainly don't want to be Russian. And I needed to say that right off the bat, since I heard you're always short with everyone. 5'1", in fact. Is it true you have two platforms, the world stage and the ones hidden in your shoes? Got his ass. Moscow is known for its beautiful domes. So I was disappointed to see yours looks like an old pimento loaf with a few strands of hair over it.
That's good. That's
like that. Not to be too personal, but I heard your penis is the size of a French fry. You're a real dictator. Dictator. In an interview once, you said you used to drive a taxi cab. Hard to believe, because you know nothing about being fair.
But he is an Uber fuck up.
Cab fare. Yeah. So one star. I heard that part of the reason you're invading Ukraine is because you want to keep Russia safe from the West. But I don't buy it. West is way too busy harassing Pete Davidson right now to mess with you.
It's true.
And hey, who needs the West or the EU when you've got the Eurasian Union, Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan? Wow, the Fab Five, if you will, just like Queer Eye's Fab Five, except you guys would all murder those guys.
You know, I had a fucking,
which is weird, because you all seem to love hanging out with bears. Speaking of TV shows, did you ever think you and the Tiger King Joe Exotic would have so much in common, like an affinity for murder for hire plots, and how you're never going to financially recover from this?
That was a cool one.
Because these sanctions, man, hoo-wee, a ruble? More like rubble, the way your bank collapsed this week, bitch. At least you've got your military. Heard they've really been turning things around and around and around, because they're lost. Did you see that video where farmers are hauling your tanks off with their tractors? I bet your troops soiled themselves.
All right, let's get into the actual updates.
I bet they cropped right in their pants.
Let's get into the actual updates from what's going on, Kate. That was very good. But what's actually happening there in Ukraine?
But maybe we can find some common ground and solve all this, Poots. For instance, I tried cooking Russian once, a beet soup recipe. It was a total abortion, the way it turned out.
it's a wonder. Hey, we are not bigger than we are.
You like to take your shirt off and ride horses. I used to take my shirt off and ride rugby guys who looked like horses. But I don't want anything to do with you.
You know this is a roast on Putin, not you.
Oh.
I used to fuck ugly dudes. In your face, Putin.
Yeah, all right. Okay, put my mic away.
Okay. Wow.
Serious stuff happening right now.
Yeah.
In Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the updates. This is, like I said, I've been refreshing and updating, and I'm sure things have even changed since we put this sheet together just like a couple hours ago. The important thing, strong resistance is continuing, even as things ramp up and other countries, the Chechens, Belarus now is starting to send troops from what I've heard. But Ukraine's also stepping things up. Here's what's going on their end. They are now calling for foreign fighters to come fight. They're in the process of setting up a foreign legion unit for international volunteers, but some are already there. Poland's border guard said Sunday that a ton of people are leaving, but some 22,000 people have crossed from Poland into Ukraine since Thursday. And the Foreign Legion already has approximately, from what I saw online, again, things that, but I heard about 7,000 so far from different places. Nolan Peterson, who writes for Coffee or Die, he's been an incredible follow on Twitter at Nolan W. Peterson. He said, these are tweets from him, just got a message from a Ukrainian Marine on the front lines near Mariupol. Hadn't heard from him in a few days and was worrying, but he just wrote, I'm alive. They hit us with everything. Keep your eyes on Mariupol. Got another message from an American volunteer who was fighting in Kiev's territory. He said, hey man, still alive. Almost died the first day, but still here. So there's, I have a question about this. They got there fast. One is a Marine Corps veteran, I guess it sounds like, who is of Ukrainian descent and is already there. I guess I'm not street smart enough to know, like, what the, how do you get there?
Well, some are living there already because of like the GI Bill and because of like VA benefits. A lot of veterans will move to different countries in the world and they will live essentially cheaply. Like if you looking at the cost of living in Ukraine, say you're a veteran with disability status and you get 1800 month in disability, you're living like a king in a lot of other countries and still receiving that paycheck. So a lot of people are live overseas already, which makes it a lot easier, but also the buildup that was essentially 6 months or whatever gives you the opportunity to come in. And I think the world reports, I just don't know how you pull the trigger essentially on that decision to actually go. Like it's one thing if I was a single dude still, like if I was single, 25, 26 years old, just got out of the Marine Corps, did my four, and I've been chilling, didn't have a whole lot of things going on. My job was kind of shitty and I wanted to go. I could definitely see myself if I was single going to do that, but I wouldn't even know where to begin to start.
I'd have to look on a map and just, I guess, figure out the best way to get close. And then
now they've created this Foreign Legion, now you can look stuff. Now there's like specific instructions for how to do it.
But the ones that are already there, they didn't use that.
Right. It's like the guys that wind up in Syria fighting ISIS randomly. You're like, mm-hmm. How did you figure that out? How did you get wherever? The internet, crazy place. But I'm interested to see.
There's probably a step-by-step way to do it on like Reddit, I bet.
I can see too, like you get out of the military and say you were infantry and you have all these skills and you're in a job you don't like and you're like, you know what? I know what the fuck I'm doing. I know I can help. Fuck it. I'm going. Like I know the type of person that I think like.
And watching videos, like watching those videos gives you, I honest to God felt a little bit of not to the same level, but a little bit of the same almost like righteous indignation about what happened. Where if you gave me the opportunity to teleport myself when you're seeing some of the horrific images that come out, if you had the opportunity just to press a button and you're there on the front lines, I think that there's a ton of people who have fought before that would do it.
Yeah. Put me in a basement, making Molotov cocktails. I'll be there. Yeah.
And the way that they transition so many of their businesses, like the breweries there, the breweries stop.
I'll get into that. Yes. Drone strikes. They have a version pretty much of the Reaper drone that is wreaking havoc, and it's a big deal. So Ukrainian TB2 drones struck a Russian supply convoy in very much a drowning pool type video, where you could basically hear the music in your head as soon as you're watching it. Mm-hmm. Such strikes show that Russia has failed to destroy Ukraine's air capability, failed to take control of the skies, failed to operate an effective air defense, and cannot jam. One of the big things Russia always touts is that they can jam communications. Well, if they're still flying drones around and stuff, that's clearly not happening.
And that's not super sophisticated drones either. Like the capabilities, I think that the West in a lot of ways assumed that Russia was where they were at cyber warfare. They just don't seem to be there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And add to the fact the trucks in the video that were targeted, they were so closely packed together and not spaced out to provide any level. And that's
now this is one. This is a question I want to have for Cons, because this is Cons' expertise. When I saw this, Cons, because on this highway, there's a 3.5 mile long highway of just convoys of tanks, heavy armed vehicles, and then they have some smaller armed vehicles as well. Couldn't you just walk a line with artillery straight up that 3.5 straight mile? It's not even a curved road. It's straight. Just walk it,
it'd be a pretty easy target. You just keep, adding 50 and keep firing for effect. it would be pretty easy. And
when you
also,
do it at how would you do it? If you were, let's say you're the artillery commander, you have your group and they're like, this is your target, engage how you would like to, where do you go?
You start in the front to just stop the operation, and then you hit them in the back and you just cripple them so they can't go anywhere. And then you just start pelting them in the middle and forget it. And they made it so easy because they weren't spaced out at all. Mm-hmm. It was really everything you're taught not to do is what they were doing. It was kind of almost unbelievable that they were that poor in their tactics, because also it wasn't like, I don't know, like 5-10 vehicles. It was hundreds of vehicles.
3.5 miles. Worth of vehicles.
In what world is that a good way to transport anything? Because if you knock off that one convoy, then you're shit out of luck.
And so they had all of their fuel in one convoy too.
Yeah.
The lack of leadership. Just contact UPS. Like, be like, how logistics matter. UPS, Amazon Prime, Bezos, how do I get all my fuel to all my tanks? Like, right, that's not Bezos the way to do it.
Of course. But yeah, a lot of things showing that they don't have as much tactical sense. There's been a lot of stuff coming out that has been confirmed showing they don't have as much tactical sense as everybody was giving them credit for. Molotov cocktail factories are popping up everywhere, like the Pravda brewery in Western Ukraine. They just tell local, like anybody, if you have any ingredients that are part of a Molotov cocktail, bring it on over. They're setting up multiple locations around the city. We'll provide the bottles. And the bottles even have their own label with a naked Putin that say Putin is a dickhead and he's got a tiny little dick. They also offer free tea and coffee to the military.
This place is awesome. I love this place. I want to, when this is all over, we should all go to Ukraine and have a drink there.
Yeah. Why not? I'm in.
And there's incredible photos. The LA Times photojournalism, their coverage of the end of Afghanistan was incredible. Some of the images, and they've been down in these Molotov factories way deep below the cities and have captured some incredible, pretty cool images of the people working together to do that. Civilians blocking tanks and convoys with their bodies. Again, like in this town, Chernihiv, the town, old, young, they linked arms and they just start walking towards these tanks and stopping them in their tracks. Psychological warfare, having Russians call their moms when they get captured and then posting the videos of the calls. And their moms are like, what, you're where? And they're like, I don't know, mom. We didn't know what we were doing, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's huge. That's huge. Ukrainian authorities on Sunday launched a website to help Russian families track down soldiers who have been captured or killed in fighting in Moscow's invasion. The site, and this is like psychological warfare big time. The site 200rf.com contains pictures of the documents and corpses of Russian soldiers Ukraine says have been killed since Putin launched the attack. According to the Ukrainian government, over the past 3 days, Ukrainian forces have captured almost 200 soldiers and more than 3,000 Russian troops had died.
I think they upped that number today up to 4,500. Yeah.
The name of the site references the well-known term Gruz 200, aka Cargo 200, that was used by Soviet military for corpses being flown back when they were in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So it's referencing another defeat. That's just brutal that you have probably Russian families going to this Ukrainian website desperate to find out if their baby is still alive, their son is still alive.
And a lot of these Russian troops are young. Like when I saw pictures of some of them, I'm like, that. They say 16 and above. There's no shot. All of them are at least 16. None.
And yes, there's like funny memes and we're all rooting obviously for Ukraine. But like, I feel for these, they're kids and they clearly don't know what the fuck they're doing. And it's tragic that like a madman is causing so much needless death and destruction.
And there's a website, I forget what website it was on, but they issued this report where a lot of Russians in the buildup were trying to flee and they were capturing the deserters and beating them in front of the other troops in order to keep people going forward and ahead. And then when they actually get into Ukraine, there was one that I saw, and I don't know if this is propaganda or not, and it's almost impossible to really find out, but they started shooting and they did not know that the rounds were live. Like once they started hitting people, they were like, oh my God. Like some of them had been told that they were doing training evolutions and these rounds were live and they had no idea.
Jesus.
Yeah. There's a lot of craziness coming out. And the Ukraine has demanded a ceasefire and a delegation is in Belarus for peace talks. They've made it clear we're here to talk with you, but we are not surrendering. We're not giving up an inch of land. We're not making any concessions in that regard. President Zelensky has also asked that the EU let Ukraine join. He filled out, I didn't know there was paperwork for it. He filled out a few pages of paperwork for it today, like he was applying for a loan, essentially. But yeah, but the second those peace talks ended, almost immediately there was a major attack launched on Kyiv. So
clearly, and some sources are saying it was during the peace talks that it was going right on, just like when the Security Council was meeting about what was going on and they started the offensive. When they're even talking about the starting the offensive, it already kicked off.
Yeah, hundreds of civilians have been killed. They estimate, as of earlier, the number was 102, but they estimate it's much, much higher. They just can't have a clear, it's hard to get tally of numbers and everything right now.
You can't Russia do battle of damage assessment when artillery right rounds and rockets and mortars and stuff like that are still going off. Can't do it.
And Russia is denying that they're targeting civilian areas, but there's so much clear evidence that they are, that it's just overwhelming.
Hundreds of apartment buildings with fucking right artillery.
Kindergartens, right, right as the kids are getting dropped off for school. Right. A cancer ward, children's cancer ward was another one. Some 422, God damn it. Ukrainians, half a million Ukrainians have fled their home and are displaced in the country. On Russia's end, Belarus might be joining and the Chechens are already on the way. There is this crazy story about special forces. Had you guys heard of the Wagner Group?
Yeah, I've read about it this morning.
So pretty much like this crazy neo-Nazi wing of the Russian military that does all sorts of covert and undercover stuff. They apparently have been in the city for weeks and months setting up for this, and allegedly have a list of many members of Ukraine's government and their family members to assassinate, including the president. So look up Wagner Group, a lot of crazy stuff about that. Reports coming out that they're bombing indiscriminately, like we just said, lots of civilians getting killed. Over the weekend, Putin and Russia's deterrence forces, he said, are on high alert. This, of course, involves nuclear arms. So when he said that over the weekend, a lot of people started freaking out, but it doesn't seem like anything's actually going on with nukes right now. So everyone stay calm. Worldwide, there's lots of teamwork going on, beginning to happen. And this thread by Richard Fontaine, he is a big NatSec guy. He was a former advisor to John McCain. But here's what each of the I just thought this was interesting. Here's what each of the countries are doing. The world's major economies, except for China, have combined to foment a financial crisis in Russia, casting aside previous worries about systemic economic risk. So all the countries besides China are pretty much been like, fuck it, let's put a stop to this. Germany has moved from a pacifist laggard on defense spending to announcing a huge increase, moving ahead 2% of the GDP. We need to stop warmongers like Putin, the chancellor said. That requires a strength of our own. So they're building up like, hey, look at us. We're going to start building up our shit in case.
And some like foreign policy experts have said that they never thought that Germany would ever get that because of World War II and the effects of World War II and how it really just decimated Germany for decades, essentially. They never wanted to have that large of a military because they didn't ever want to feel like they could use it or have to use it again. So they didn't want to, but they see the threats that are looming. And I imagine it's not just Russia, but China as well.
Yeah. Finland and Sweden are firmly aligned with the West against Moscow, and the invasion may tip them into NATO membership. Neutral Switzerland of all places, will freeze Russian assets as a result of Moscow's aggression.
Huge.
Full neutrality has become untenable given popular revulsion at the invasion. So the people of Switzerland are like, no, we have to do something as a country. And so they are. The sanctions response has been global, with Japan, South Korea, Australia, Singapore, and more joining the anti-aggression bloc. Economic and geopolitical implications stretch well beyond Europe. China is badly exposed by this. They have trumpeted a no-limits friendship with Russia, and it is openly siding not with the numerous wealthy, powerful, and unified countries, but rather with a country that now looks reckless and isolated and impoverished. So this is also making China look very bad. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if behind the scenes, China's like, Putin, what the fuck are you doing? You're fucking embarrassing us, dude. You're like fucking clown. The world is disconnecting Russia from globalization benefits. So trade, travel, finance, tech, and they're drawing a curtain around the country. So they're going to make the country much poorer and more isolated. So this is going to piss the people of Russia off too. Also, they'll be also saying like,
oh, okay, and those different types of protests and shit like that in Russia are getting out of control too. Like they had one that was right outside the Kremlin that reached 15,000 people the other day. That's and that's in a place where typically if you go and protest against the government, you're taken to jail right away. And so they are just saying, we don't care. This is wrong. We don't want any part of it. And I think more and more Russian citizens are going to find out because Ukrainian's president is being pretty smart in how he's approaching things.
Yeah. And the EU, which is usually, you know, and they've still been pretty slow on a lot of stuff here, but they're helping fund fighter jets that are going to go to the Ukraine. And all this was just over a weekend. So it's been pretty effective. The Russian ruble has completely crashed. Their stock exchange didn't open today as we're recording on Monday. There's a big world meeting of sorts this morning where all the countries, again, were like, let's make sure we're all on the same page and that we're doing more to fuck Putin up, essentially. And his funds have been frozen, too. So he's got billions and billions. I was reading about his finances. So incredibly, crazily shady. But he's a multi-billionaire, essentially. And everyone's kind of being like, well, good, you can't get any of it right now. You can't access it. So
and they stopped him from using the federal dollar, like the US dollar at all, where in order to get some of those things back and try to have a little bit money replacing inside their coffers, can't do it. There's no US dollar transferred allowed in Russia, except for some pipelines, but that's only to keep the global supply chain apparently going. But there, I think in this, there has been no negative talk really by a lot of Western journalists and Western military folks. There is some things that are being done by Ukrainians as well that are incredibly fucked up. And I think it's wrong to ignore that. Like we mentioned the Wagner group from Russia that has brutal tactics and that they are essentially mercenaries for hire. They spent time in Syria. They spent time in Iraq. They also went to Afghanistan at certain times, but they are brutal. But there's the Azov battalion that's for Ukraine. They are essentially like Nazis, like, and they are doing things that are just incredibly wrong. When the Chechens are coming, for example, they know that Chechens are predominantly Islamic and they are putting the bullets in the lard and pig's lard and shit like that. War crimes. They're doing all those different things. There's hundreds of Africans that are in Ukraine that are going to school and trying to become doctors and things like that, participating there and have lived there for a long time. They're being forced off of trains, the women and children, just because they're black and they're from Africa. They're not being treated. They're being treated like second class citizens. So while we are weeping for the Ukrainian people, it's difficult to have the attention of the world and still practice atrocities, having women and children not be able to get on trains to get out of Ukraine and achieve safety simply for the color of their skin is wrong as well.
Well, and that's part of it too, is those people of color that are making it to the borders are also having trouble getting out of Ukraine because the other countries are saying, and you're seeing it in the news coverage too, people are talking about how some reporters for certain news sites were straight up saying it, well, we feel this more because these people are blonde haired and blue eyed was like an actual.
Well, they said it's the first time that we've seen TikTok or seen social media in civilized country wars between civilized countries, which Iraq is the seat of mankind. Like that's where everything started. And it's because they're brown. Like that's the only reason.
Yeah. There's a lot of different things that are getting shown in the light here that are not good. And it's been, this whole thing has just been, like I said, I keep refreshing. And it's just craziness.
And so, because you want to try to grab a hold of it, because here in America, it's not like we don't even go deep into our own history. I mean, hell, I didn't find out there was Japanese internment camps till I was in college and I was like 28 years old. So, I mean, we don't know a shit ton about a lot, especially when you're considering the rest of the world. So over the weekend, there was different experts on different news stations talking this and that. And I saw a clip that was on Trey Gowdy's program that's from Fox News. And I wanted to share that because there was a colonel on before this woman that we're going to share in just a moment. But there was a colonel that was on, and Jennifer Griffin, who's with Fox News Channel, who does a great job of reporting all across the world. She started her career in Moscow with Fox News. She went on and said that she needed to correct the record about the previous guest and that there was 10 minutes of wrong things that he said. Here's what she had to say about why Putin's motivations are the way that they are. Here she is.
Well, thank you, Trey. And before we get started, I just heard your last guess, and I feel like I need to correct some of the things that Colonel Doug McGregor just said, because, and I'm not sure 10 minutes is enough time to do so, because there were so many distortions in what he just said, and talking about the West and NATO vilifying Putin and sounding like an apologist for Putin, and talking about how Putin, he thinks he knows how far Putin wants to go. I don't think anyone that I've spoken to here at the Pentagon or elsewhere in Western intelligence believes they know how far Putin wants to go. And I think that the world has seen what Putin is capable of. And to blame NATO membership for what we've seen Putin unleash, we've seen from Putin's own words that he is talking in czarist terms from a 19th century view of imperial Russia. So those what he just said was so distorted that I do feel that our audience needs to know the truth. In terms of Putin, I've known and seen Vladimir Putin operate since 1999 when I was based in Moscow for Fox. It's where I started my career with Fox. And Vladimir Putin is a former KGB agent. He's been laying the groundwork for this, and he's been, whether it was invading Georgia in 2008, we've talked about the invasion in 2014, the kind of appeasement talk that Colonel Doug McGregor, who should know better, because when he was in government, he was the one who was advising President Trump to pull all U.S. troops out of Germany. That kind of projection of withdrawal and weakness is what made Putin think that he could actually move into a sovereign country like Ukraine.
So in that clip, when you hear that clip and the things that are going on, there's certain aspects historically that I don't know. I assume that you don't know either. Khan's internet is gone, so he doesn't know either, I would assume. Maybe he does. He went to West Point. He might know. So I wanted to seek out an expert who could give us some of the background of what's going on from a different perspective. Oftentimes, we have military guests on. We have people who are in Congress. We have people who are working in government, who work at the DOD or the VA. We have all those different types of people. But there are certain people who are academicians, who are members of the upper echelon of intelligentsia, who have the ability to speak about theater-to-theater operations much more than we do, and give the historical conflicts where it is people groups and religion. Nola Haynes is one of those folks, and she has a Master's of Divinity from Harvard University. She teaches at Pepperdine. She is finishing her PhD, which will be done in May, and she is currently going to one of the top foreign policy schools in the world at USC, University of Southern California. Nola Haynes is an impressive person, and she gave some context to this story about imperialism, about colonialism, and yes, spoiler alert, about white supremacy. All of those things are now zero at Blog 30. I'm privileged to have Nola Haynes. Nola is a professor. She is an expert in foreign policy and national security. She's been all over the place lately. If you've been watching TV, you've probably seen her. She's been on NBC, MSNBC, CNN, all over the spot. But I reached out to her because I saw some comments that she was making, and I thought, you know, it's so great to get a different perspective. Kate, Cons, and I all have military background and things like that. So I wanted to get somebody that comes from a little bit more of an academic approach, that knows more. Like if you listen to the episode that we released yesterday, you know that we're not very academic. We're just going off of feels and how this stuff makes us feel. We wanted to get some of the actual nuts to bolts of what's happening. Nola, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited about virtually sitting down and talking to you. But I will say, so CNN hasn't invited me yet. I did see that on Twitter. So I feel like my academic ethics, I'm forced to make that disclaimer.
Well, some people say you don't want to be on CNN anywhere. I want to be on TV all the time. Get me on TV and I'll go. I don't care what channel it is. It could be on that one of those weird channels that's like 1,240, where they just do 1970s Latin music hits. And I'd be on that if they invited me on. But I want our audience to get a little bit of your background. How did you get into the national security world?
Ooh, that is a very, very interesting story. So this is my second career. So, you know, a lot of people ask me about not just being an academic, but, you know, if you've seen me a little bit, you see, you know, that you know, have a little flair, have a little style. And, you know, I love glam and all that. And, you know, I, full disclosure, I was an actress at a very young age. So I still have a lot of that, you know, swag and style and creative energy. So I bring that to my presentation, you know, even with my nails and all these things. I
a show lot more put together than me. For sure.
So that kind of like explains, you know, one part of my identity and a first part of my professional life. And then being from New Orleans, Louisiana, proud native, Hurricane Katrina definitely was a defining moment for me. I was incensed by the negative portrayal of New Orleans during that time. And that was not my experience growing up at all. The complete opposite, you know, and that was a motivating factor for me. So I, you know, literally just went to school. I locked my hair. I wasn't like the, you know, the light brown black girl with the curly hair anymore. You know, I like locked my hair. I took school very, very seriously. I wasn't putting my acting before my education. And I just like, man, I was just on fire. You know, I did community college for a few years, transferred to UCLA. Where I majored in political science. And so that's where I kind of like got that really kind of early fire. I thought I was going to be an engineer like my dad. So I actually started out in geology. I started out in like earth sciences.
Wow.
And then got the bug, you know, took a political science class. And I was like, okay, this is for me. And then because my early research always around politics, it was more of a domestic look at class politics and religion in New Orleans and race. And so that research got me to Harvard Divinity School. And it was really there, believe it or not, studying God, that I made my pivot towards national security. And
interesting, because I was a seminarian too. I don't know if you know that or not.
Oh, you know what?
I went to Southwest Seminary or Southeastern Seminary and just outside of Raleigh, North Carolina. And I wanted to be a pastor before I joined the Marine Corps.
Wow. Okay. I like that connection. So you kind of get it.
Yeah.
I will say when I first got there though, it was purely academic research. And then I pivoted towards the MDiv and got the professional degree, stood there 3 years, learned Arabic, really, really dove into, you know, training and as an interfaith chaplain. And, but a very crucial thing happened. So while you have the class collision of Occupy Boston, New York, going on, you also had Boston bombings. And so I've talked about this before publicly, and, you know, I've gotten some interesting comments and pushback from Americans, like, that wasn't even like a really big deal. And I'm like, well, if you were there, it was, if you were there, it was a really big deal.
Right.
And especially, you know, those brothers, they, a lot of their lives touched people's lives that lived like on the Cambridge side of the river. You know, the one who's in jail now, he went to Cambridge Middle School. I like lived on that street. You know, his brother like worked out at a place that I would go to sometimes to box, you know. A cop at MIT was murdered, you know. The Tarzaneff brother was found in Watertown, a town right next door to Harvard. Right. And then you go to the siege and the whole town, the whole city is shut down. You know, you hear nothing but sirens. There's no life moving. Although, you know, we were in grad school and the liquor store was open. So kudos to them. Like they got us through. and so, you know, like that was a very real experience. And then coupled with, I was taking Arabic at the time, and this one particular thing happened to me standing at the bus stop outside of the law school. This white dude walked up to me and spit on me. I had my hair wrapped, so, and I had this big giant Arabic book, so something that I was giving off, he just assumed, you know, oh, she must be a Muslim woman, you know, let me attack her some sort of way. So all of those things like really, really impacted me. I was working with some young Muslim girls at Suffolk University who was scared to wear their hijab. You know, I was in class with girls, you know, also having the same conversation. And then also at that time at the Divinity School, Leila Ahmed's book had just came out about veiling, and it was huge. So it was like all of this kind of energy around identity and terrorism, right? And the way that I approached terrorism was through religion and theology. Mm-hmm. So that was my pivot towards national security. Graduated from there, came back to California, worked in the DEIA space for a little bit at UCLA. I've always done that work parallel to my academic work, and was also applying to PhD programs in political science. And I got into the political science and international relations program at USC. USC really focuses on IR. So that's definitely a place, you know, if you're interested in international relations, you want to be there, if you're in Southern California, especially. So that's kind of been my progression. And so the way that I think about national security and identity is through, I mean, national security and foreign policy is through an identity lens. Mm-hmm. Case in point, I have a foreign policy paper coming out with New America about, you know, we need to codify our commitment to diversity. It can't just be like this ebb and flow depending on which administration is in office. You know, they can just, you know, change it at will. We need to make a commitment and stand on it, right? So what do we value? So that's kind of like what that policy paper is about. And all of my work, you know, chaps, like, you have no idea, when I first started introducing these ideas, they were not popular.
Oh, you know, not because it's outside the box. And I think that's part of the reason why I've been so enthralled with your analysis on different situations, because it comes from such a different perspective. And I think a lot of times we ignore it a lot in the military community, those that are in, at least people who look like me do, because it does typically come from a white lens and how we view the world. And that's just essentially how it's always been in the military. So when you're hearing different perspectives, like you introduced it's on your timeline now, and I think it was on MSNBC, where you begin to talk about the situation that's happening in Ukraine and using your education to enlighten you and to enlighten others about what's possibly happening there, I found it to be fascinating. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about what you were talking about, what the ambassador for Kenya was explaining during the National Security Council, the Security Council with the UN yesterday?
Yes. So thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to really kind of like, you know, talk about these ideas. So within the vast world of political science, there are all of these different little places. So American political science is like where most political scientists live, right? So international relations has typically always been like a niche part of IR, and definitely people who look more like you than me were in those spaces.
Just probably shaved and actually like look handsome.
you know, it was definitely a guy's club in terms of these dense theories about, you know, the international system and balance of power and securitization and all of these fancy concepts, you know, deterrence. And so for me, I've always been the type of academic where I am inspired by real world events, right? I do not believe that I can be an effective academic just reading my books. Okay. So I'm going somewhere with that. So for me, coming out of the Divinity School, Harvard Divinity School is a very unique place because it's definitely not a sectarian place. Like they let you do whatever it is that you want to do. And post-colonial theology actually was really kind of popping when I was there. So I had this kind of post-colonial framework from being
I think that's the only place in the world you could say post-colonial theology is popping. Is that Harvard? That might be the first time.
So is biblical feminism is popping too.
That's the first time in the history of mankind that sentence has ever been said.
Hey.
It works. It's right.
But it's true. So having all of these different kind of post-colonial frameworks, you start to see the international system very differently. You know, you see the international system from the position of the other, so to speak, right? The marginalized groups, the people who have been impacted by colonialism and empire building the most, right? So if that's largely my framework, while also being in international relations, I cannot get away from realism, you know, neorealism, realism. You cannot get away from these traditional World War II ideas about the world, right? So depending on your perspective and depending on how you view the world, you know, some people are shocked that Putin wasn't a good guy. He wasn't a gentleman after all, and he wasn't really concerned.
He lied? This is outrageous.
You know, engagements of war. Like, how dare he, you know? And however, if you are Ambassador Kimani, who gave that amazing speech about, listen, we know what this is. We know what it looks like. This is imperialism. Putin is talking over Ukraine as if they have no value as human beings. He believes that there is some historical claim, not only to the lands, but to the people, to the culture, you know, even going as far as saying that, you know, basically giving them independence was a huge mistake. And, you know, in my work, you hear a lot of these types of ideas if you are looking at it a particular way. You see what I'm saying? Like, if you study race at all, if you study identity at all, if you study post-colonial anything at all, your lens is going to be different. So where some people might hear securitizing language one way, I can hear it multiple ways, right? So I think what the ambassador really highlighted was we kind of need to expand the ways that we are thinking about what's actually happening. Okay, this is a lot more than Putin violating international law. That's been standing law since 1945. This is Putin trying to recapture the mythological wonder of the former USSR. And how is he going to do that? He's going to break the law. He's going to make a claim of historical lands. We heard that rhetoric in 1939, right? And then something very interesting that he did, because Putin's not stupid, you know, he's the OG spy. So he understands that he has to use legalese to a degree. So he charged Ukraine with genocide. And then before anyone can come in and say, this is reminiscent of Hitler in 1939, he claims they are Nazis.
He almost tried to like B-rabbit him from 8 Mile, like where he,
right?
That's essentially what he tried to do.
I mean, It was very interesting. So while you definitely see these very similar strands to what happened in 1939, there are stark differences, you know. But like I said, I just really enjoyed how the ambassador framed, to my mind, kind of like this pivot towards thinking a little bit differently in terms of these kind of more traditional symmetrical engagements of war, you know. And I'll even go as far as to say, I've been having this conversation a lot, depending on how you look at it. I was talking to a practitioner friend just last night. There have been asymmetrical attacks for a minute now. You know, if you consider cyber attacks an actual attack, I know in
Which
my arms
control and
you know what I'm saying? In my arms control and international security class that I used to teach at Pepperdine, my students would ask all the time, like, well, what is an act of war if these cyber attacks are not acts of war? And as a person who pays attention to identity and the way it is completely destabilizing us internally, domestically, a lot of people don't pay attention to that, but I do, you know, like, our issue with racism and white supremacy and identity bias, it is literally tearing this country apart and it is reverberating around the world, right? Putin smells blood in the water. He sees us being vulnerable. So he's testing us, right? That's what the bully does, right? The bully's testing.
Yeah, and Sebastian Unger does a great job in explaining that identity essentially crisis that you're talking about in his book, Tribe. And we've had him on the show too. And another part of your story that I find fascinating, or the way that you go about it, is that you, correct me if I'm wrong, there's so many that just describe Putin as a crazy person or he's insane, and that's really dismissive to what he's doing and what he's capable of doing, correct?
Absolutely. And you know, that is maybe perhaps a weakness in our American exceptionalist ideology, right? To just kind of dismiss and demean. And I can tell you as a Black woman in this space, you know, I still, you know, I still get dismissed and demeaned, you know, and I have all of these receipts, you know, so it's this thing that we do, right? And especially if you have a concept of the world that says, well, there's virtually peace in the Western post-World War II European world, right? So everyone's pretty much thinking that, of course, it's going to remain that way, right? Like Putin's just popping off, but he wouldn't be acting in the interest of Russia if he did anything. Mind you, this man has been pushing, he's been like doing this since 1999. This is the fourth time he's illegally invaded a space. You know, he would tell a different narrative, but this is the fourth time, right?
I'm gonna trust you instead of him.
I mean, you know, I just think after last
unless you've poisoned people too, if I find that out, that I'm out on you too.
So listen, after last night, gloves are off. Let's just call a thing, right? This man has been blowing smoke and setting fires for quite some time. However, I do see opportunities. And if people's analysis are anywhere, you know, correct about this, you know, the USSR ended because they went a step too far in Afghanistan. And there are a lot of experts saying that what he did in Ukraine last night will be, you know, basically the repeat of what happened in the 70s.
And how do you think this ultimately ends? Like from your perspective, because he is so much about identity, and I think he wants to be the next kind of czar of sorts, where he wants to have that type of reputation where he brings back Mother Russia and things like that. But there is a ton of reports that, because I think that the American mind, and even in the military community, veteran community, we look at somebody like Putin and you see a dictator, you see somebody who's authoritarian, and you look at what he does, and you would imagine, based on, I guess, principle and what we view history as, or how we view history maybe without knowledge, and we see him, you would think that all the troops are in lockstep behind him and wanting to do what he wants to do. Putin's goals would be the goal of the troop. We're not really seeing that. And there's a lot of reports coming out from Western intelligence that are saying that that's not the case. And in fact, there was a story that came out on Yahoo today that said many of those soldiers that he has were, in fact, beaten into compliance to make them go into Ukraine. Do you think that that is going to drastically affect how this operation continues?
Yes and no. So, you know, Russia isn't a democracy. This woman yelled at me on Twitter the other night because I called it a communist state. And she was like, it's a social democracy. Call it what you want to call it. There's a dictator in charge, right? Which is to say, you know, he's going to be the president for life to the end of his natural life. Russia is definitely still very state-centric, even if they've moved away from the communist label. They're still very state-centric, which is to say, they don't need anyone voting for them. They don't really need the people to go along. However, one of the things that a lot of folks were talking about in the wee hours in Twitter spaces, I was in this room, this huge room with a lot of stock market folk. And one of the things that they were talking about,
those people, I'm so sorry. Those people are the worst.
Their analysis was a tiny bit different from mine, but there was one thing that I found interesting. They were talking about how, first of all, you know, the ruble compared to the dollar plummeted, and that Russians were taking money out of the ATMs in the banks. Right. So, which is to say that they are no longer trusting whatever Putin's financial plan might be. Right. So in as much he doesn't need them to vote for him, you know, you still need your population to participate in the economy. So that's what you need to keep an eye on. And, you know, I would be very, very, very just kind of like, I don't even know how to say it, but I think about this and I'm having a hard time articulating because I'm getting very emotional about it. In as much as we're talking about, you know, the international system shifting and, you know, the balance of power, people are going to be talking about balance of power until the day they die. You know, there's definitely a clash of the titans here, almost like a self-fulfilling self-fulfilling prophecy of East versus West, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how long have we been hearing about, you know, that great clash? Mm-hmm. So, but I care about real people. You know, I care about what's happening at the dinner table. I care about what's happening at the Russian dinner table, the Ukrainian dinner table, the global dinner table. I care about what's happening at the gas pumps, right? So as a director of a nonprofit, you know, that's all about women and security, this is something we've been talking a lot about. One of the points that I push back on when people say that the round of 2014 sanctions didn't work, I'm like, well, what if you are a mom at the grocery store and the food prices just went up 30% pre-COVID? Right. I think that makes a difference in a household.
Oh, definitely.
That makes a difference in a household, especially in a system that doesn't necessarily, you know, go out of its way to protect women's rights. Case in point, 2017, Russia rolled back their protections for women against domestic violence. You know, so I'm thinking about the women in this situation, you know, the women in Russia. I'm thinking about what's going to happen to the women in Ukraine, right? I'm thinking about what's going to happen to the children. I'm thinking about what's going to happen to the elderly folks, what's going to happen to disabled folks, what's going to happen to people on the margins. And yes, there are folks of color in Ukraine and Russia, you know, and typically when things go sideways, the most vulnerable communities are always the most put upon. So these are the things that I'm thinking about in addition to the big systemic, you know, international systemic things.
Yeah. And that's something that we try to encourage our listeners to do, is because you look at Russia and same thing with North Korea and all the other quote bad actors and axis of evil and all that. And you look at Russian and you think every Russian is like Vladimir Putin. Yeah. That's just not true. And it's the same thing as when we leave Afghanistan and the next thing you know, 13 million people are in famine and can't eat. Like there is a responsibility to be a humanitarian across the board. And I think when people start beating the war drums, it's not going to affect the President Putins of the world. It's not going to affect the Emmanuel Macrons of the world. It's going to affect the women and children, the people that are trying to feed their families. That's who these wars affect. And we have to get past this spot where we look at everything just on lines on a map. And that's why the Ukraine situation is so fucked up, is because these people are just existing. Like they're just existing. And the next thing you know, they have fighter jets dropping bombs. They have people coming in with tear gas. They have bodies lining on the streets. I mean, they're doing a damn good job of fighting back, and we're real proud of them too for the effort that they're putting back. But it's awful to watch the human cost.
It is, you know, circling back to when I had mentioned earlier that I care very deeply about working, getting the experience of working as a practitioner. I am so just kind of uniquely blessed as an academic to also be able to write in the policy space, to be an authority in that regard. However, you know, I also, as a, you know, I work on Afghan resettlement. I don't think we talked about this, but every other day, you know, I hear the real human voices. I hear the impact of a humanitarian crisis. That is real. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, it's mostly women calling with their babies in the background, trying to figure out how to help their family that may still be in Afghanistan, or maybe they are the ones who can speak English better than other folks. And so these aren't talking points for me, right? Like I've been involved in this work since September, you know, not too long after the NEO, and this work is grueling. It is traumatic. It is heartbreaking as an American, as a civilian in this space, having to say to someone, you know, well, you know, my resources are limited. There's only so much that I can do. And yes, I know that the Taliban is trying to kill you, but there's nothing that I can really do about it. Right. So let's broaden that out. You know, when you have, I'm not going to go to the extent to say that Putin is a Taliban. I'm not making that connection. However, when we are talking about not caring about women's rights, you are essentially making them an incredibly vulnerable group of folks, right? So in that regard, you know, I am very, very worried about women being forced under a regime potentially, or women in Russia whose food bill is going to go up, you know, gas prices are going to go up. You know, what is that mother going to have to do to feed her children in a state that really doesn't care about her humanity?
Yeah.
So it's so many different things, you know, it's so many different things.
Yeah. And I think your comparison of Putin to the Taliban, it doesn't, you don't have to be the most evil person in the world to still be evil. Like, you could still be brutal and it doesn't have to be that type of brutality, but he's still very, very brutal. The last thing that I'll keep you for, but we'd love to have you back another time. The last question that I'll have for you, given President Biden's statements on the types of sanctions that the United States is going to impose, the mm-hmm. United States and the rest of the world community is going to impose on President Putin and his ilk, how do you think that those are going to play out? Do you think that the president went too far, not far enough, or just right?
You know, as a person who like has spent hours and hours and hours and hours studying sanctions, it is like one of the most tedious things that you could ever do.
When you said that you write policy, I almost fell asleep. Like having to type that kind of stuff where it all matters, because in that kind of writing, a comma splice changes the entire meaning of what you're trying to say.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Sanctions are definitely a powerful tool. You know, I'm not necessarily worshiping at the altar of sanctions. However, I am not a pessimist just to like throw it out the window and say that they don't work. Mm-hmm. Now, the big difference between the 2014 sanctions and the sanctions today, where the first round of sanctions a few nights ago were an expansion of the existing 2014 sanctions and some sanctions from 2018. There are new sanctions, a fresh new round of sanctions on very particular entities. And there's been one big one kind of out there regarding SWIFT. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to hear a lot about that. Basically, you know, your entryway into participating in global finance, right? And so while Russia's been threatened with that before.
It's like PayPal for the world, essentially.
PayPal for the world, but maybe, you know, you may not get like a icky message about, hey boo, hey, girl, mm-hmm. you fine, you know, mm-hmm. no.
see people buying weed on there. They're not buying weed on SWIFT.
right. So, but you know, to have this ability as a world power, you know, Russia's economy doesn't necessarily reflect its military might, but it's always privileged. You know, it's put, you know, its military might, and that's worked for them. So, you are essentially talking about a world power not being able to participate, you know, in this system. And there are a lot of entities in that system. So
that would bar them. They're also big in arms deals too. That would also bar them from being able to sell to different of our allies and things like that. And that's a huge source of income for them.
Huge source of income. And so we've threatened them with it, but we've never really pulled the lever on that. Right. And so I think none of us were surprised about the Nord Stream 2. And this is what I want to say. I want to say, you know, as a person who studies security, the Biden administration, yes, Putin went into Ukraine. But when I tell you the intelligence community got it spot on, mm-hmm. that is a different type of win, right? I think the strategy of transparency as deterrence to bring our security partners in, you know, because we were having some trust issues from the last administration, you know, to the big lie, to 1/6, you know, going all the way back to George Floyd, all of these internal things have a direct impact to what's happening today. So you have the Biden administration that has to work to repair these relationships, right? And not only do that in real time, but for them to make public commitments, for Germany to say, we will take the economic hit, that really is, that's a testament to the Biden administration, it's a testament to international security alliances, it's a testament to, you know, the liberal system in many, the liberal institutional system. But there are flaws because there are more autocrats and dictators, you know, emerging in the system and people moving away from democracies. That's not the direction we wanted things to go in, but that's what's happening. So we have to meet that moment. We have to meet the moment of living in an international system that's not filled with gentlemen. You know, they're not necessarily interested.
You don't get to be the president of your country or prime minister of your country by having little ambition.
Exactly. So, you know, and then we didn't talk much about China. I'm definitely not a China expert, but in terms of them, you know, aligning more closely to Russia, that definitely just sets up, you know, this power struggle between the East and the West, democracy and some other political forms of social democracy slash communism slash dictatorship slash autocracy versus, you know, coalition building and alliances and actually meaning when you sign a piece of paper, when you sign a treaty, that you're going to try at the very least to, you know, keep your word, you know.
Just give it a little effort, just a tiny little bit of effort. When you go.
I'm so irritated with people who are just like, you know, Russia violated Minsk. Let's backtrack all the way up to when Ukraine first got their independence. And there was a little thing called the Budapest Memorandum that was signed, that Russia signed onto, that said, we're going to respect Ukraine's sovereignty. Ukraine had to give up a lot of their weapons, mostly all of their weapons. And a lot of Ukrainians are very upset about that moment in history, because in 2014, Mr. Putin said, honey, oh, that was a different government. I have nothing to do with that. Okay. So you were dealing with these types of people. Like, that had nothing to do with me, honey.
I kind of like that, though. I mean, we got to be honest. When he does something good, like, he's like, that's not me. I didn't do that. You can't, don't put that on me. That ain't me. I mean, I was here. I was very involved, but don't put that on me.
I mean, you know, all of these treaties and all these things that Russia have kind of like lightly, you know, signed on to, like even as early as January, Russia recommitted to the nuclear proliferation treaty. Will he? Won't he? Right. You know, he's already threatened to take it all the way. So
him doing that is like me telling my wife I'm actually going to cook four times this week. Like, we all know I'm ordering Uber Eats. It's just not happening. Like, I'm not going to do that. Nola, I want to thank you so much for your time. We'd love to have you back and share more stories and more of your insight. It was very valuable. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And where can people find your work and donate to your organization?
Oh, thank you. So Women of Color Advancing Peace and Security. I am the director of the West Coast chapter, and we have chapters all around the world. Our headquarters is in DC. We have chapters in France. We have chapters in Ghana. So you can definitely find me on the WCAPS.org website. It's under West Coast. And then also all of my social media is Nola Haynes. I like to keep it simple. So, find me there. Definitely follow the work that we're doing on WCAPS. And if you are on the West Coast, please, 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 please become a member. Or if you're whatever city you're in, become a member, especially if you work around or have interest in security. We welcome men, women, they, everyone. We are all inclusive. And the work that we are doing, you know, privileging the health and safety of women around the world, it is one of the most incredible experiences of my professional career. So that's where you can find me. And that's who we are at WCAPS. And Chaps, thank you so much. And I would love to come back.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm going to be on Nicole Wallace tomorrow. Oh,
okay.
Yes, honey. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Tiffany Cross Saturday morning. So shout out to MSNBC, you know, for giving this Black woman a platform. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nola. When I left that conversation, I thought about everything that she said, especially the latter parts of the conversation, a lot, like mm-hmm. how it affects you and how looking and you see it. Like she said this to me on Friday. I interviewed her on either Thursday or Friday of last week, had not seen a single video about what was happening with the Africans in Ukraine. And when I saw it, I was like, my God, man, she is fucking right about everything she said. That's mm-hmm. where it comes from. Like, that is imperialism, it's colonialism, and it's white supremacy in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's again, it's good to get different perspectives because it's shit. Like, honestly, I hadn't seen it until right over the weekend, and I wouldn't have even thought to seek out stories like that. So
the two people that I've heard from that most impact on their interpretation of what's going on was from the ambassador of Kenya whenever he was speaking to the UN, and then Nola Haynes. Like, and it's not even close. Like, the analysis that I've seen from other places, it's not even close to what those two have provided. And hopefully they don't need to provide it much longer, because the world, it seems the world is looking at authoritarian type leadership right now and saying, you know what? Fuck no, no. Like, we don't want that shit. And that's at the time, like, all this stuff is going on in Ukraine, and you have a sitting member of Congress who goes down to a white supremacy fucking CPAC or whatever it was, with Nick Fuentes, the white supremacist Nazi, and Marjorie Greene Taylor, Taylor Greene, whatever the fuck it is. She's out there and getting up right after this dude's talking about, they say that Putin's like Hitler. I don't know if that's a bad thing or not. Like, and you have a member of Congress that's speaking at that same type of conference. It's bullshit all the way across the board. Hopefully Friday we'll have more clarity about what's going on. There'll be the initial invasion of Ukraine is over. Hopefully the conflict is over because they're having peace talks. I doubt that. But
yeah, what do you?
I don't know.
People keep asking me. I'm like, I have no idea.
We don't know. No one knows. U.S. intelligence doesn't know. No one knows what's going on. The only thing that we know is that it's horrific. As I think, one of the biggest concerns that folks have, that I've gotten over and over again since Putin announced that they are going to have the nuclear deterrence team activated, or whatever the fuck they phrased it as, just this so much bullshit as their peacekeeping mission that they were initially going to have. When I heard that, I thought, I don't think it's possible. One, because oligarchs, like the billionaires in Russia, they don't want that. You're seeing high profile billionaires from Russia already speaking out against Putin, which in the past that has not happened. Ovechkin, who is one of the most notable Russians in the United States and has lived here for 20 years, he is usually very pro Putin. I mean, even up until the invasion, his profile picture on Twitter was him having a Stanley Cup ring, and President Putin was in the picture with him. Even he's like, we don't want war. The people who are notable in Russia are all saying no. Eventually, that type of thing is going to erode the trust and the fear of President Putin. I put out a thread, or put out a tweet this weekend, that I really believe is true. What happens in Ukraine, even if they temporarily take control of Ukraine and set up a puppet government, the fear that Putin elicits to the people in the Eastern Bloc is gone, I believe. Because they see the way that the Ukrainians have fought, and that they have that fighting spirit and have kicked the fucking shit out of them in a lot of ways. Will and might mean more than material weapons. And we saw that with our own forces. I mean, America's forces compared to what folks in Iraq and Afghanistan had at their disposal was night and day. Didn't matter. In a lot of places, they whooped our asses in a lot of ways. Like, and it made it very difficult. I don't know how you move on if you're Putin. I don't know how he recovers, and I don't think he ever will.
And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, great. I think it's a great thing, Kate. You're absolutely right.
And also, my roast, there's no way he'll recover.
Oh, no way. Like, once he hears that bad boy, he might as well just pack it up. Putin's going to have to get the fuck out of Russia, and he's not even going to be able to use a good company like our good friends at Cross Country Mortgage, because Putin, you can get out and you're not moving in. We are going to move, though, with Cross Country Mortgage. They're dedicated to whatever it takes to help you set up with a great mortgage, and they're experts. Keep things simple and clear along the way with no mind games. Cross Country Mortgage has a team of loan officers dedicated to getting the best possible loan terms available. They have an average close time of 21 days, which is ridiculously fast. Make sure that you're going with them at crosscountrymortgage.com/barstool, so Cross Country Mortgage can take care of you through the whole buying process. But it's not just buying, it's refinancing, anything basically you could do with the house. If you're just looking to refinance, if you want to take out some of your equity, because a lot of folks, if you've been in your house for a while and you saw the housing boom of this last year, you probably picked up some equity. You can get that out for I don't know if it's free, for a low fee, and do all those things. Go to ccm.com/barstool so Cross Country Mortgage can take care of you through the home buying process. All right, let's move on to save rounds and alibis. Catherine?
I mean, this sounds silly to say now that I finally got my fridge, for anyone who cares.
My God. Oh my God.
Okay, fine. Southern tree. Fine.
No, it's fine. Tell us about your fridge, Kate.
I don't like it.
Oh no. You waited like 6 months for this thing. Why don't you like it?
They bought it's the cheapest. It has no handles on it. It's just a giant silver square. And when you tug on it, the whole fridge moves. You got to really rip the doors open. There's no handles. Anyway.
You got to move. You got to get the fuck out of there.
There's no water or ice machine or anything in it, which I know there's worse things going on. Okay. In context. I know. You know what? It's a great fridge.
No. See, I think that's how you're feeling, Kate, is valid.
And it's making all my food taste like new fridge smell.
Oh, that is the worst. It's almost like whenever
got a hoagie the other day.
It's like drinking water from a hose and you can still taste the rubber.
Yes. So you think you guys got this new fridge, man.